Welcome to El Paso Food Voices. I'm Mary de la Barca, your hostess for today's episode. El Paso Food Voices focus on bringing you a taste of the culinary living history that flavors the foodscape of El Paso del Norte region. In each episode, our guests share their personal connections to a unique aspect of this region's foodscape. Today's episode, our guest, Valerie Alcalde, will be speaking about her passion and her journey through the world of sotol, a drink from the Chihuahuan Desert. Valerie, thank you for coming and welcome. Bienvenida.
Thank you very much, Meredith. It's an honor to be here talking to you guys about something that I love very much.
So as we begin our conversation, I want to share a little story about why we're talking about sotol today, because I think it's sort of, it says something about what I do not know. I tend to be the kind of person that when I go to a restaurant, I drink a beer and I have to share it with a friend because I can't even finish one beer. But the specificity about sotol is that in another episode, we had a guest, Alejandro Borunda, who is co-owner of a restaurant or taqueria. It's called Taconeta. And it has a bar section. He's also the co-owner of a bar here in El Paso called International Bar. And in our conversation, he started mentioning sotol. And one of the things that he said is that we people from the Chihuahuan area, the Chihuahuan Desert, from the region where we are located in El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, should really be drinking sotol instead of mezcal or tequila, because the way he put it is, it's our heritage. It's a drink that really represents our heritage because it's made with a plant that grows in this region. So that got me thinking, it's like, we need to learn about sotol. So that's what brings us to you today. So thank you for coming to our show. And I would like to begin by first having you tell us a little bit about you, so that our guests know who are you and what's your relationship to the El Paso area. And then just walk us through your journey as to how you got into the world of sotol.
Great. Well, I was born in Michoacán, in Uruapan, Michoacán. I obviously didn't grow up there. I grew up here in El Paso. My dad worked for the Mexican government, so he was always stationed in various parts, and usually it was in the border. Like we also lived in Tijuana and Ensenada, and we moved to Juarez when I was 6 years old. I went to school pretty much since I was 6 years old in the El Paso area. So I guess only if you grew up in the border do you really understand that you grew up very different from anywhere else, right? My Mexican family that is not from the border or they thought that we were kind of crazy. Like, yeah, we go to school in the U.S. and then we come back and that's the life, right? Of course, this was pre 9/11. So, I mean, the bridges and the lines were, I don't know, half an hour at the most. And to tell someone, yeah, I go to the U.S. and have lunch there and then come back to Mexico and then I can have breakfast in the U.S. They can't really fathom it. And I think that also the relationship that both cities have is also very different, you know, like people think that, oh, you're right by Texas. It must be very racist. And I really never have experienced any racism here, not even in Lubbock, Texas. That's where I went to college. But anyway, I'm going off. I grew up here in Juarez, and of course I went to school in El Paso, and for college I went to school in Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas. From there, it took me to various places. I also, in between college, because I graduated in economics and international business. In between, I lived in Italy and I lived in Luxembourg. I did an internship in Luxembourg. And then I was studying just in Italy. I was studying the language, which was supposed to be 2 months, and it ended up being a year. And then my dad saw, like, either you pay for your own things or you come back and finish school. So it was, I really had no choice, right? So I came back and finished college, and I had taken so many classes. I mean, because I first started an international business, and I had an amazing professor, economics professor, that really got me into the whole concept of economy and how, the psychology and economy and how you can have the same resources or, and then suddenly because of the psychology of the people, you know, it's like you don't have anything at all, right? And countries go down and all of that. But anyway, I graduated from college from Texas Tech, lived in Austin for a little bit, and then I moved to Wisconsin and worked as an international business developer for Emerson. And I was pretty much very unhappy there because of the weather. Like people tell me, well, did you get to see a lot? I'm like, no, because it was in the polar vortex time. So it was extremely cold. I would go into work at 8 in the morning, which was pitch dark, and then come out of work at 5 p.m., which was pitch dark. And I wasn't very happy, and it was just harder to, coming from Austin, Texas, which, you know, everybody has like a Peter Pan life over there. and then you go into, and it's harder to get to know people. People are a little bit colder, but very nice. I can't really complain. From there, my visa wasn't renewed. The company, yes, but my working visa. And so it was kind of like, what do I do? And of course, my mom always growing up in the border, she always said, no, you guys are going to work in the U.S. Your life is going to be in the U.S. But I felt like a calling to come back. I didn't.
To come back to Juarez?
To Mexico. Yeah, to Mexico. Mm-hmm. And it's always this thinking that, oh, you're not going to make it in Mexico. You know, it's going to be harder and all that. But I had this huge calling to come back. And I decided, because I was doing pretty well economically in that work, and I decided to take like a 6-month sabbatical, and I moved to Oaxaca. I moved to Zipolite, and right by the coast. And I lived there for 2 months. From there, a friend of mine in college, it's really funny because the Latinos, we would hang around a lot with the Turkish community there, the Turkish students. And one of my best friends, she invited me to Turkey, to Istanbul, and I was supposedly going to go and to learn the language. But no, I ended up, you know, just drinking and eating too much.
That's a way of learning.
Right. I did learn the culture. Yeah, the Turkish people are just really warm-hearted and really nice people. And the food is amazing, too. And I came back with 15 pounds more and I came back and it was kind of like, okay, well, I need to, know what I'm going to do now. And between that time, obviously, too, I went into kind of my first spiritual journey, I guess. I wasn't really very religious at all, you know. It was like I grew up in a family that, you know, oh, you're Catholic, you know, but we weren't really religious or anything. But I went to a ceremony in Oaxaca with a curandera, and it was with mushrooms, with psilocybin. And that pretty much it was kind of in that end zone that, like, what am I going to do with my life? And that kind of made me open to a broad spectrum of the world, I guess, because it was even the world within me, right? So that was my first, I guess, encounter with something that I could call a spiritual, you know, energy. From there, I did ayahuasca in Chiapas, and then I obviously went to Turkey, came back, and it was kind of okay for my birthday. I wanted to go to I knew that from there when I came back, it was okay. What am I going to do, right? And I ended up trying a sotol. I grew up with sotol. My dad. I have to go back to that, right? I grew up drinking sotol. My dad. Even when we were like my sister and I were like 7 or 9 years old. I was 7. My sister 9 or 10 actually. And he would always give us a little sip. And my mom would be like, "What are you doing? They're so young." And my dad would always say, "I want them to learn how to drink, so no one comes and tries to get them, get them drunk. You know, I want them to be women that know how to drink." And my dad would always say, "Oh, this is better than tequila or mezcal, you know, this is," and he would buy them in like these little gallons, right? Because my dad is from Chihuahua City. I always knew what sotol was. And so I came back and it was this whole movement of how mezcal was was growing so much and all that. And I said, to myself, well, I think that the next one is going to be Sotol. I saw like an opportunity that maybe this is going to be the next great thing. And there were two or three brands that already existed that were doing that, you know, and it was, you know, in a premium Sotol and, you know, with the proper bottles and all of that, you know, everything that has to do with the marketing. So I said, well, I pretty much had to go move back to my parents' house, and went on a journey of trying to find a maestro, right?
So let me backtrack a little bit. So in a previous conversation, when you're talking about your first spiritual journey, you made a comment that it wasn't one of those rituals, or ceremonies, that it somehow, some calling came to you to return to Chihuahua and to start more actively exploring and learning about Sotol and making this your path journey. Did I understand you correctly?
Yes. It was actually in because again, my first experience with plant medicine was with psilocybin and then ayahuasca, and then the third one was with jicuri, which is peyote, and this was in Wirikuta, in the desert of Wirikuta in San Luis Potosi, and It was in my birthday, and it was kind of like, okay, the idea of Sotol was there, but it was kind of, you know, broad. And I went in that ceremony. It was like the message was, yes, do this, but you have to do homage or honor to the people there, right? And you're not, and don't do it as a form of money, right? Do it as a form of culture. If you're going to concentrate on this, do it because you want to bring the culture back, right? And that's actually how I got also the name, because even though that was in San Luis Potosí, I said you have to pay homage to the people of there, and that's why the name.
And by there, you're referring to
in Chihuahua. Yes, in Chihuahua. Yes.
So this journey, this trajectory that you're sharing with us, and this ceremony that said, you know, Sotol is something that I'm interested in, but now being committed to it, that eventually has led you to have your own label, your own label brand, which is called
Sotol Raramuri.
So let's begin there. Let's begin with Raramuri. Let's explain to our audience why Raramuri, because you're talking about this idea of honoring the culture. So tell us a bit.
So it's actually the full name of the brand is Sotol Sura Raramuri, which means heart of Raramuri. First of all, it was to pay homage to the people of the region, which is the Raramuris. Sometimes they're called Tarahumaras, which is wrongly given. The Tarahumara is the region, but they called Tarahumara. The Spaniards would call them Tarahumaras. Raramuri means light feet people because of the way they run, and you know these extraordinary miles and you know distances. I mean, and to me, it was kind of like what the Sotol plant represents. The Sotol plant, it grows in the desert, and it also grows in the Sierra Madre, which are these extreme weathers. So it's like a super plant. And to me, the Raramuri are like super humans, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about the plant. You mentioned the plant. So I'm going to leave it to you to give us the scientific name of this plant and also its popular or more commonly known name, and how and why is that really connected with the Chihuahuan region?
Okay, so the Sotol plant actually, it's also called Desilirium, and depending on the variety, it changes. Well, they're all Desilirium. That's the scientific name. For example, I have two varieties, which is Desilirium wuliri and Desilirium alufolium. And it just depends, for example, the ones, wuliri would be the most general one that you can find more often. In the desert, you can find Texanum. And then there's right now up to 11 different varieties. But, there, you know, as time goes by, there's going to be more.
And its common name, I believe, is called something about Desert Spoon.
Yes, in English, it's Desert Spoon. You can see them here in El Paso. You can see them. You can see them in Arizona. Talking about the region in the U.S. In Texas, they grow abundantly. You can even find them in, for example, places that are not so close to Chihuahua. Oaxaca also has it. They even have a drink too, but it's not called sotol. Of course, sotol is only denomination of origin, and there's only three states, and it's Coahuila, Durango, and Chihuahua, of course. But for example, the one that they have in Oaxaca, they call it palmilla. Oh no, never mind. And the one in Sonora, they call it palmilla. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And here for our audience who are you know, from El Paso, from this area of Chihuahua, one way to identify the plant in the desert, it's part of the, it looks like a, is it part of it or looks like a yucca?
Yes. It looks like a yucca. It has a lot of leaves, I guess you would call them. It's big. It's also it used to be categorized as an agave, but it turns out that it's not an agave. It's actually from the asparagus family, and so also the onion family, because of the way the roots are and how it grows. When you cut the leaves, which would be the center is called the heart, and in Spanish we say jimar. We jimamos la planta. And it's exposed, and it looks like a heart, right? And it looks like, I guess, kind of like a pineapple without the little thingies, right? And that's called the heart. And that's also kind of the emblem of a heart of Rarámuri, right? Like the heart of the plant, too. And,
This plant, because I tried to do a little research and understand the difference between this. I'm going to use the common name, at least in the United States, the desert spoon. Mm-hmm. That it's a wild, una planta silvestre, right? Mm-hmm. And that in itself leads to a different kind of way in which you produce the sotol versus the agave. So I guess what I'm getting at is, can you talk a little bit to us about the process? The plant is wild. It's not actually specifically commercialized or cultivated for the commercialization of the sotol. So talk a little bit to us a little bit about the process as to how people, I guess I'm asking, let's talk about the sotoleros or sotoleras. How does the process go in terms of going from a plant? How do they harvest it? What do they harvest about the plant? And then we end up with this result.
It's very different. I'll start a little bit talking about a little bit of the differences between what an agave plant and the sotol plant, or how both of them are made. The sotol plant is very unique because it only gives you from 1 to 2 liters, a mature plant of sotol, versus an agave can give you 6 to 7 liters, right? Just one. Also, for an agave to reach maturity, it can be, you know, up to 6-7 years. And the sotol plant, sometimes it's 12 to 15 years, right? So that in itself could be a worry of conservation, right? The sotol plant is completely wildly harvested. There are agaves, and there are certain types of agaves that are still wildly harvested. I, for example, travel a lot to Michoacán, and there's many agaves like the Inakidens and some Cupriata that are you know, wildly harvested. So this becomes a matter, and I guess all of them started wildly harvested. And as there's more demand, then there were more less resources of finding an agave that was wildly harvested. Right now, there is a worry that this could happen also with the sotol plant, because obviously when there's an interest economically, there's going to be more, you know, more brands, and if there's more brands, well, less of the mentality to preserve, right? And so that is something that we should take care of. We have to take care of, because what versus something that is planted and industrialized versus something that is organic and wildly harvested that grows from the earth naturally and all that, you can even see the difference in the taste, you know. If right now, for example, if you look at the agave, just the blue agave alone, there's more than 6,000 brands and there's only six producers. I mean, what do you think is going to happen with you know, with that amount of demand, right? Even, I mean, I don't want to talk bad about tequila, right?
No, and I don't mean to talk about it. I'm just talking more. I'm thinking more of environmental issues.
Yeah,
ecological issues. Because I know that one of the few little things that I do know about sort of the agave production is that in order to make mezcal, you actually have to dig out the plant. I mean, you have to like uproot the plant, right?
Yes.
And that has an effect on the soil and. To have soil to be ready to be harvested again, it takes years. For the soil to get all the minerals back into it. And in terms of the plant for the sotol, which is what we call here, the desert spoon, is that it reproduces itself with the same seeds because you're not cutting the plants from the roots, right? So organically, they just keep reproducing themselves and sustaining themselves. So I see, to me, that seems like an interesting... It raises an interesting question about sustainability and being more environmentally
conscious,
aware.
Yeah.
But it does raise the questions that if sotol, which of course in certain ways we might want it to be much more, have more demand for it and people will drink it more and so forth, that the concern then will be, like you said, is it going to be, if it becomes too commercialized and too successful in terms of a commodity.
Exactly.
What would that mean then in terms of this wild plant? And what would it mean? Let's go back to Los Soteleros. What do we mean? What do we that mean to a traditional way of making this drink? So talk to us about for your label for your work. Are the Soteleros, the people that are producing this, following traditional methods of doing so?
Yes.
And what are those methods?
There's definitely. Going back to the worrying, you know, of will it still exist right now in the market? Anyway, I'm going off on another kind of that has to do with that, but you asked me a certain thing. Yeah, so my maestro sotolero, I started off with someone from the desert, right, for another different maestro sotolero. And then I changed to, because either sotol is from the, like I said, desert or from the
Sierra,
yeah, mm-hmm. From the forest. It's a matter of choice of what do you prefer. Even though I'm from the desert, I personally prefer the taste of the sotols from the Sierra. To me, they're just more earthy and, you know, like wet soil and piney and all of that. But not to say that it's better. I'm just saying it's a matter of taste, right? This sotol has a very peculiar history because in the age of Prohibition, the Mexican government, because of economical reasons, they wanted only whiskey to be produced in the state of Chihuahua. So they made it illegal for sotol to be produced. And why do you think that? Well, there was a lot of demand for whiskey, right? This was with Plutarco Elias Calles, the president, and many of them, of course, with corruption and all that, they owned a lot of the the land, right? So if you were ever caught in Vinatas, which is the distillery, you with a vinata, the vinatas would be burned down or you would go to jail, sometimes even killed, you know. And it was until the 1990s, of course, Prohibition passes and all that, and it was still illegal by the books, right, to produce sotol. And it was until the 1990s that it became legal again. Can you imagine? So it was like, 40 years that it was, what is it? 70 years, right? Mm-hmm. Or like 60 years. A huge portion was kind of, stolen, right? Because, I mean, growing up, it's kind of like, oh, that is sotol, you know, that's what that's a mentality, right, of people in Chihuahua. Oh, that is sotol. Oh, you're going to wake up blind, you know, because it's so strong, right? But that is the mentality that tequila and mezcal had to go through. And something peculiar happens that it's a little bit of a criticism of our own culture in Mexico, right? We don't know what we have until a foreigner comes and tells us that it's good, right? So it was the Europeans and the Americans that started getting, you know, more interested in tequila and afterwards in mezcal. And then that's how, you know, the appreciation comes, you know, because they saw the process. They saw the process that it's even more, I would say, elegant and natural than even the whiskey, right? I mean, and it comes someone else to tell us how to appreciate our own things, mm-hmm. right? My maestro is fifth generation, sotol maker. He is a character. His name is Don Fernandez. He's such a character. He lives in the Sierra, right by Madera. And I really enjoy working with him because, of course, being a woman, there has been a little bit of challenges. And they see me as a woman and they see me as a fresa, right? Like a yuppie, you know, in their eyes. And which I'm not, but and so it's very challenging because they don't take you serious, you know. And so I love working with him because he talks to me like I'm another man, you know, like just direct, you know, like how Chihuahuans are known, you know, just like he cusses in front of me and he says this and he makes jokes and this, but he's all very, very respectful, no, but he doesn't. He doesn't, I've had other experiences with other sotoleros or maestro sotoleros that they don't really take me serious or they, you know, think I'm dumb or all of that, but I like him. And I think it's because he has four daughters. He doesn't have any. And so he's a widower. And I think that, you know, that by itself, and that to me is awesome, you know, and right. Yeah, he's an incredible man, incredible man.
Explain to us, you've used the term maestro sotolero, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, the master, the he has the crafts, he's a craftsman, person that makes it all. What are the, if you can just sort of walk us briefly, what are the skills, or how does somebody becomes a maestro sotolero?
I think they're alchemists, you know, because I've tasted, I mean, you have to take account the soil, right? I think there's this magic that goes on with spirits. I mean, first of all, why is it called a spirit? You know, these beverages are called spirits because you extract the spirit of the plant, you know? So to me is something very magical that has to do both with the soil, I mean, the weather, and of course the alchemist, you know, and everything that is growing around. I mean, you take a sip of sotol from the forest, and you are tasting the pines that grew up right beside, you know, you are tasting the temperature that, you know, at that time, whether it was cold, well, that means that it was longer it takes to ferment, right? Because in cold weathers, and this is one of the highest points in Mexico, so it's one of the coldest. And you are tasting, you know, just the life of the soil of the Pachamama, right? And then after the alchemist, because you can grab a book and, or be a chemist and oh, you need this and this and that, right? To when you're fermenting, you know, first you cook the heart under, I guess, I'm going to the process now.
Yeah. Let me interrupt you for a second, because you use a very powerful word that I absolutely love this word and love the concept and the spirit, but I'm not sure if all of our audiences would know what it is. Pachamama.
Yeah. So Pachamama is Mother Earth. You know, and it's the spirit of our mother, right? And everything
earth
is that
mother.
Earth, yeah. Mm-hmm. And to me, that you know, going back into the ceremonies, I understood that, you know, that we're living under this being, right, or above this being that has created us. We come from that, right? And everything comes from that. Everything is spirit, whether you want to call it spirit or universe or nature or whatever. There's a spirit that creates everything, you know. And right. To me, I think a perfect example is when you do something industrialized, when you do it without spirit, when you do it just, you know, to make things fast and give you more, you lose that. And that's the thing with this artisanal process that I've seen with the sotoleros, right? It's these are artisanal and they are ancestral processes, you know, back then.
To remain connected to
yeah,
the
Yeah, they're great grandfathers, exactly, mm-hmm. you know. And you know, it's the whole process is just so natural, you know. It's under soil. What do underground?
You dig a pit, like a pit, right?
Yeah, it's a pit. It's a pit underground, and it's surrounded with volcanic rock, And then you burn, you pretty much, not burn, you cook the hearts.
The hearts.
The piñas. And for 4 to 5 days, and sometimes a little bit longer if it's cold, you know. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you chop them up by hand, and then you take them to these stills where it's going to ferment. And again, it's very different from the desert, you know, the process, because just of the time that it takes, you know, when it's colder, when it's hot, it takes longer, and it ferments with its own sugars. And then from there, you take it to the, you drain it, and then you take it to the distillation process, right? And they go by twice distillation. And then you just have magic, you know? I mean, I taste that with also different mezcals, Ruda. I think that every soil in Mexico gives you a different story, you know? Right. The soil in Michoacán is a whole different story. To me, it's a story when you're having a little bit of sotol, you know. It's a story of the soil again, of the spirit of the plant, of everything that grew around. And again, it takes an alchemist to do a good thing, you know.
Let me interrupt you here, because mm-hmm. you're trying to connect a couple of things here. You know, when we think of the soil, the taste of the land, the soil. And thinking of the soil as Mama Pacha, Pachamama, sorry, I'll say it backwards. I have dyslexia, that's my excuse. you know, by the earth and the spirit. It's interesting that we don't speak more about the spirit or Pachamama. And we speak a lot about Tatar, which is the French word about, you know, the place. Mm. But it's the same principle, is that you know, when you're doing wine and in, you know, the depending on where the grape is grown, and you have that the flavor of that place. Here we're talking about the flavor of place too, but we are adding not forgetting the notion of spirit, exactly. The notion of our connection, a relationship, or a connection, a relationship to this powerful concept. This powerful, it's not even a concept, because it's really an energy.
Exactly.
Of Mother Earth. Yeah. And having this connection, this respect, this relationship, I think, you know, for people who like to talk about food tasting like plays, maybe we need to like use this Quechua concept of Pachamama, and you know, once again, like you were talking a minute ago about appreciating what is ours in terms of our you know, continent or indigenous peoples of the Americas,
yeah.
Is to use the concepts and the philosophies and the connections to the earth and to Mother Earth. Because like I said, it's almost the same principle as Tatar, but we hear more about that, at least in the world of food studies, mm-hmm. Food culture, than we hear about the spirit of Mother Earth.
Exactly.
So, I just want to interrupt that.
Really powerful. Everything is spirit, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, everything. I talk to we call him el abuelo, right? Because I do vision quests. This year I finished my fourth one, and I was talking to him, and I said, well, what about, you know, a spider that comes and kills you, or a snake that comes and kills you? He says, you have to understand that everything is God, everything is spirit, everything. Mm. I mean, the plants talk, the plants have their own spirit, the plants are their own entity as animals, as humans, you know. Mm. And once we understand it, it's very magical, you know. And then, and me getting into this, it was beautiful, just the process, right? And everything talking to you, everything is...
So spirit it has no time, so to speak. But sotol does have some sort of time, because I understand that it is considered sotol joven, that the concept of añejo, age sotol, is not as common as it would be in agave. Can you talk... I mean, is that even true or not?
So... Let's go back a little bit. There's actually a great movement right now that started, you know, with as more people were getting to know mezcal, and of going back to the roots. The whole process of aged or reposado and all that was something that tequila was doing to cater to the taste of the foreigner, right?
The taste of the whiskey?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly. Cause and so it doesn't go back to the roots of where it's going, right? And I think it's a wonderful thing that's what's happening now. Like instead of, you know, they're used to kind of like tequila, you know, it's 38 proof. I guess it would be, what is it? 36. It would be, because you double it, right? In the US, it's 72 proof. Mm-hmm. And sotol, or a good mezcal, is, you know, 100 proof, you know, at least. And I think it's going back to how it used to be done. Instead of watering it down, no, you know, right after the second distillation, you bottle it, and whatever that comes out, that's what you're going to bottle, right? And I think more and more tastes are going into not aging, because what's the point of aging if it's only going to taste like wood, right? I mean, you want to know what the plant, you know, tastes like. You want to know where it grew, you know? You want to know what grew around it, you know?
So the difference then between drinking something that is joven,
yes,
versus something that it is age, añejo, is the focus on the wood in which you are, you know, preserving it for years and years and years, or is the point of drinking and tasting and connecting to those flavors of earth, once again?
Exactly. That is exactly how I see it, right? And I think that's the point of it, right? Of going back to the roots of how it was made. And even, I mean, and I understand, I mean, these are strong drinks, but there's even a way of drinking it, even when you breathe, you know. Obviously, you're not going to take a shot, you know, that is,
and then
no.
You sip.
Yes,
you sip. You don't do shots of sotol.
Like how they say, right, in mezcal, you kiss it, you know.
It's a little
kiss, a little peck, and you drain yourself into the experience of where it's coming from, right?
Is this something that you recommend, that people take a, have a kiss?
Exactly.
Before a meal, during a meal, after a meal?
I would recommend.
In between meals, all day long? I don't know. I mean, kisses are good, so maybe we should have kisses all the time. I don't know.
Maybe not all day long. I'm not a promoter of drunkenness, right? And that's another thing that but maybe, you know, during a great conversation with someone, or after a wonderful meal, that's what it was the tradition, right? When you know
the drink for sobremesa,
or the big machos, you know, that's in Jalisco, right? That they would fix their problems, right, with a drink of tequila, right? And to me, the best conversations can be that. Not when you're already inebriated, right? But pre. Yes, I don't support inebriation.
good. Is there something else? I think we already talked a little bit about the difference between this drink and mezcal, which is what most people know. Is there something else about either the process of how it's cultivated and made the product, about the artisan of the process, the person who makes it, the people that make it, something else that we haven't touched about that you would like to actually make sure that we address?
Well, right now, since of course the market with mezcal has grown a lot, there is obviously it's growing kind of like how tequila had its start. So it's more industrialized, not all. No, don't get me wrong. There's more brands, I guess, that industrialize, and they're harvesting and all that, not naturally, you're not just plantations, mm-hmm. and all of that. With sotol right now, we can say that it's, you know, wildly harvested, at least my brand. I don't want to name one brand, but there's yes. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, like, it goes back to the earth, right? You know, there's still the natural forms and all that. But that is a worrisome thing, because more people are coming into the market. And mm-hmm. and one thing that I would advise consumers is to look up into that, you know, like, don't buy something because it's, you know, famous or has more money for branding. Buy something that is, you know, is respectful of the earth, right?
So basically learned a little bit about the process of...
Exactly.
Of what we are consuming.
Exactly.
So maybe we can cooperate a little bit in our consumption to maintain...
Yeah, something that happened in Mezcal, in Oaxaca, when there were, you know, when there were, you know, what's the... they were quemando, taking out a lot of the agaves. There was this movement of conservation that came, for each agave, you have to plant three. And so I think that's a great, you know, if each agave that you take out, you plant three. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that, that's something that, that should be done in everyone, right? Because, I mean, there's Sotol, there's Raicilla, there's Bacanora, which are the smaller ones that are not known, and the ones that are getting a little bit more traction as the years go by. And I think that to be ahead of the game, have more respect and plant more, right? Yeah.
And that process of respect or give back, what we mentioned earlier about that Quechua word that I always pronounce backwards.
Pachamama.
Gracias, thank you, Pachamama. Uh-huh. It actually kind of goes back to the same principle, because when you take something from earth, when you take a plant from earth, you know, you speak to it, you ask permission, you ask for forgiveness, but you also have to give something back.
Exactly.
To it. So you know, this preservation, we might call it preservation, but it's based on a principle that is an indigenous principle to people of this continent.
Exactly.
And I think it's important to remember that too.
Yeah. It's a ritual, I think, that in everything, right, you have to give back, even when in a transaction with someone, right? There's always a transaction. And I think that if there's no respect, the forces of being will come back and of karma will somehow, you know, level. I think there's always a leveling off, right? Whatever it is. And I mean, also me using the images of you know, old images of indigenous people. Two of them are Apache, two of them are Rarámuri, and my four varieties.
So what are the four varieties that you have?
So I have a joven blanco. And a semi-reposado, we only age it for 3 months in an old barrel because we want nothing of, you know, losing the taste. And then we have the premium, which is our premium Sotolio Folum. And then we have also a churique. Now, a churique is very interesting. Churique is an agave. It would be, if Chihuahua had denomination of origin of mezcal, we would call it mezcal, but in the Sierra, they call it churique. In the lower Sierra, they call it lechuguilla, but in the upper Sierra, they call it churique. What was I? Oh, yeah. So two of my labels have the faces of two Apaches, Chiricahua, from the region of Casas Grandes, and two of the Rarámuris. And so what I wanted to pay respect and asked also the governess of the Rarámuris if she found it, you know, if she approved, if she had, you know, if she found anything of the labels offensive, and she approved. And also we go once a year during the winter. And again, this is a concept of giving back, right? And we donate a lot of food and also weather clothes and blankets and all that to the Rarámuris. And if anyone would be interested in also donating clothing or anything like that, we're very welcome.
Okay, great. And if somebody's, they can probably find me through El Paso Food Voices webpage, and I will be happy to put them in contact with
awesome.
You. So
that'd
be wonderful. Awesome. So I think we've covered a lot. In another occasion, we'll invite you back to tell us more about how exactly nominations are made in terms of which states can call what particular product. That's something that you brought up, but we'll leave it for another discussion.
Perfect. Yeah.
So thank you for coming once again. We want to thank your guest for today, Valerie Alcalde, for sharing your passion on this wonderful drink. And I still would like to call it, even though we have plants in Oaxaca, I'm going to call it from a native plant of the Chihuahuan desert.
Of course. Yes. We have to be proud of this.
Yes.
You know, yeah. I always say that our body's going to accept it better because we have it on our DNA. It's in our region, right?
Right. So. And that's what I'm going to conclude with, inviting the guests to go have a kiss of heritage. Let's put it that. I like that. A kiss of heritage.
Wonderful.
After their next meal, drinking some sotol.
Yeah.
So once again, thank you. Muchas gracias. Ha sido un placer.
Merida, thank you very much. There's nothing better than talking about something that I love so much. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.
El Paso Food Voices was created by Meredith E. Abarca, Professor of Food Studies and Literature at the University of Texas at El Paso. Produced by Adrian Mesa from UTEP's Creative Studios To learn more about how food practices, memories, and stories shape a city's history, culture, and its character, please visit us at El Paso Food Voices. Thank you.